Welcome, everyone, to the LaRue Show. This is Saturday, October 9th, 2010. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and we are going to be discussing two very interrelated matters. The fact that over this past week, Mr. Lyndon LaRouche issued a specific call for removing President Obama from office under the Section 4 of Amendment 25 to the United States Constitution, which makes provision and procedures for just the kind of emergency our nation is in right now. We're then going to go with our guests, who I'll introduce in a minute, to discuss what this action would make way for.
Hello.
And here is our first guest, Jeff Steinberg. Welcome, who's going to give us an update.
Hello.
You are coming through loud and clear. Go right ahead.
I know the problem.
Actually, Jeff can't hear us. He's speaking to us from Washington, D.C. And his reception to hear that he's on the show will be clarified in just a minute. But Jeff has been directly involved in the circulating and making known what's involved in this amendment, Section 4. It's just technical matters, and Jeff will be on right.
Okay, I got one thing I have to do here. Jean-Philippe, I'm going to drop you out, and when Jeff's done, we'll get back to you.
Thanks. That's sure. George in our studio, and he'll make this connection. And besides Jean-Philippe, you heard his name. He's Mr. LeBleu from Montreal. We're also going to have Hal Cooper, our transportation and infrastructure engineer. He's waiting on the line from Seattle. So when we soon get Jeff Steinberg hooked in, and here it comes, we'll hear the update from Jeff. Very good.
Oh, hello.
Jeff, we hear you loud and clear.
Excellent.
And I said you would be giving us the update on the response to what's very clear to Lyndon LaRouche's call, that we have the procedure in this Amendment 25 to the Constitution for dealing with the crisis. So go right ahead.
Well, I think the important thing is to set the backdrop to why Mr. LaRouche made this call precisely at this moment. And the simple reason is that not only is it absolutely true that the president has lost it mentally and is in a state of psychological meltdown that warrants the invoking of the Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. But that beyond that, it's very clear that there are other important and powerful political forces in the country that have come around to the same conclusion. And I think you've got to go back to Mr. LaRouche's international webcast of April 11th, 2009. This was right at the time that President Obama had made his first big overseas trip since taking office, had gone over to England and had genuflected in front of the Queen and came back in a really crazy state of mind then. And at that time, LaRouche said, we're dealing with a Nero Hitler-type narcissist personality, and his psychology will very rapidly become a dangerous national security issue. At the time, he was saying that if surrounded by the proper advisors, this mental condition could be controlled. But since then, we've seen that that's really not the case. So since the beginning of September, in particular, there have been a series of public revelations coming out of people very close to the White House, including some people who have served on the White House staff as recently as a month ago, who provided some absolutely damning details about the president's collapsing state of mind, the temper tantrums, the state of depression, reports that he's on medication, other reports that everybody in Washington is on medication. The problem in his case is that the medication's not working. So what we have is a kind of outpouring of evidence that is the trigger factor for taking the measures that are specified under the Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. I think it's important that people also know a bit of the history of this. Right after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the issue of presidential succession obviously came up once again as a very important issue that had to be fully clarified. And in fact, there were concerns that came up also over the question of what happens if the president is shot but happens to survive an assassination attempt, but may be physically or mentally incapacitated. So the Senate in particular debated this issue long and hard. Some leading people, both House and Senate, came up with a bipartisan draft of what became the 25th Amendment, and Section 4 basically spelled out that if it appears that the president is physically or mentally incapacitated, it's the responsibility of the vice president and leading members of the cabinet to make that determination and to formally submit a letter to the Senate, President pro tem of the Senate and Speaker of the House, to make it known that the president is unable to continue to serve, and that the vice president immediately takes over as acting president. Now, the elected president has the prerogative, if he disagrees, to challenge that, and there's a whole procedure for convening the Congress to review all of the evidence and for the Congress to vote by a two-thirds majority whether the president stays or goes. So it was thought out. There were competent psychiatrists who participated in the deliberations. There were every major medical association was directly involved. So we have a procedure in place. In fact, that procedure was considered but was not invoked twice during the Reagan presidency. Once the day that he was shot in 1981, and the second time it was invoked or considered being invoked was during the height of the Iran-Contra affair, where some people claimed that the president was showing signs of not being mentally able to continue to serve. Howard Baker, the new White House chief of staff, examined the question and concluded that the president was perfectly fine to serve the term out. And that's what happened. But this is not some bizarre conspiracy thing. This is a procedure that was put in place precisely because it's absolutely essential because of the importance of the institution of the presidency under our Constitution, that the president is functioning. And right now, the evidence is pouring in from people closest to Obama, closest to the White House, members of the cabinet, members of the White House staff, who are expressing alarm that he may not be able to do it. And this is the job of the vice president and the members of the cabinet to come to that conclusion one way or the other.
Okay, Jeff, thank you. That couldn't put it more clearly. It is urgent. And if you do you need to get off now, we can let you go.
Yeah, I better. Okay. Let me just say one thing in closing.
Please.
Which is there are a group of patriots, and this is not a partisan issue. These are not right-wing Republicans or anything of the sort, but there are a group of very serious patriots, people in both the Democratic and Republican parties, some who've been serving in this administration, people in the intelligence services, in the military, who are very much aware of this situation. They've done their part. They've, in some cases, given anonymous interviews so that the facts of the matter are out there and are presented. And what we know is that there was a certain expectation. In fact, even a dependency on the idea that Lyndon LaRouche, surveying the situation, being very close to what's going on in and around the White House, would do the right thing and would put the issue on the table. And so the fact that it's done by LaRouche, the fact that it's now out there publicly that the 25th Amendment Section 4 must be invoked in the immediate days and weeks ahead is a critical factor at play right now, and you can't evaluate what's going on in the policymaking in Washington, what's going on in the run-up to the November elections, without taking this very, very sharply into account. So on that note, yeah, I'd probably better just hang it up and leave it to the rest of you to continue.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Thanks
My
again.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So as we leave from Jeff Steinberg's update on this urgent situation, we can return while we reconnect to Jean-Philippe Lebleu, who's waiting in Montreal. We can return to this, what lies ahead after we succeed in having, let's say, call it retiring President Obama, that what this amounts to is making way for the kind of emergency actions needed in the United States with international impact, which will be establishing conditions for a credit system for real economic development through the principle and fact of the Glass-Steagall Act from 1933. We need to reinstitute it, break the speculative anti-development imperial system that anyway is now blowing apart and devastating nations. It was in the headlines, I think, this week, what we already know, that the spigot has turned on for unlimited hyperinflation. That was the term spigot was used by the Wall Street Journal, but we don't need confirmation from sources like that. We see it all around the emergency situation we have in the country. So in the forefront of the being able to move ahead on the projects we need is the North American Water and Power Alliance on our continent, which would be uplifting the situation, certainly changing the physical economic environment and changing the morale and the potential for creativity for centuries and generations ahead. Now, that's why we asked today, after the update on our immediate task on doing everything to see that Obama's out of office as fast as possible, we asked for our panel of two guests. One, I'm going to now thank, welcome Hal Cooper in Seattle.
Marcia, thank you very much.
And Hal, I think we go back maybe 15 years or more since you were working on things in the 1990s.
Right.
Hal's been back and forth across the Atlantic to, especially on the need for a world rail system, the critical link up of the Bering Strait to be built. And we'll get to that. But I want to just say, in the latest EIR online, that would be for October 8th, is a write-up of a conference at which Hal Cooper spoke in Berlin, Germany. It was September 25. It brought together a speaker from Russia, from the Geologic Museum, the Vernadsky Institute there. It brought together a spokesman for Africa and Hal Cooper representing the United States. And the title of this conference, sponsored by the Schiller Institute and addressed by its director, Helga Zepp LaRouche, is Full Steam Ahead to Rebuild a Shattered World. That wasn't the conference title, that's this write-up. So Hal's presentation at that conference will be in the October 15th EIR, the one that will be posted this coming week. And we will get into the content of this, and I hope by now I can welcome Jean-Philippe Lebleu. Are you on the line?
Yes, hi, Marcia.
Very good. Who is very active in Canada, visits the United States a lot. For all I know, Europe and elsewhere, he gets around, and he's a leader of our LaRouche Youth Movement and the Committee for the Republic of Canada in Canada. And so I think what we, without any more introduction, let me just ask Hal, would you just go into the who, what, and where on the Bering Strait link up, which you spoke of at the Berlin conference and so integral to the North American Water and Power Alliance and to the development of the planet? Give us the parameters, what's involved here.
Thank you, Marcia. I presented a speech two weeks ago today, on the Bering Strait Tunnel. I was the second speaker after Helga. And I concentrated my comments on the proposal to build the Bering Strait Tunnel as an adjunct to the North American Water and Power Alliance. And what it would really involve is building a tunnel 65 miles long, about 105 kilometers, between Chukotka at the far eastern end of Russia and Alaska at the far western end between Wales and Ulan, the two very small fishing communities right now, which actually would be part of a 5,000-mile, 8,000-kilometer-long interconnection between the railway systems of Asia and North America, going from Prince George, British Columbia, to Skovorodino in the Amur Republic of Russia in the east.
Those are the two pre-existing connection points, is that what you're telling us?
Those would be the main connection points to the Trans-Siberian Railway and, of course, to the Canadian National Railway main line going through Western Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So we would tie the North American and Asian rail systems together. What this would be a double-track electric railroad where we would be hauling both freight and passengers, and it would go to the tunnel in far western Alaska, far northeastern Russia as the critical connecting link. There is a question of gauges of the railways, because the Russian gauge is just very slightly wider than the standard gauge, which both the United States and Europe use, and China. And that's, there are some technical solutions for that now, but really a long-run solution is that they really all have to be converted to the same gauge at some time in the future, but that's a question to be dealt with in the future, not in the present. The railway would really connect the forest and mining areas in northwestern Canada, in northern British Columbia, and the Yukon Territory, and go across Alaska, basically paralleling the Alaska Highway, between the border at Alcan and in Fairbanks, and then going west, largely along the north bank of the Yukon River, and then going through the Brooks Mountain Range to the west at the Seward Peninsula, and finally emerging at a place called Wales at the Bering Strait. And then there would be a tunnel built. The water there is anywhere from 30 to 60 meters deep. It's 180 to 200 feet deep at the maximum. The tunnel would be built underneath that in basically what's granite and limestone chalk formations there, relatively stable geologically. The active zone is several hundred miles to the south of the Aleutian Islands. And then it would go into Russia and go around the north end of the Tenkanyi Mountains to a place called Egvikanat, which is a fishing and mining village and a port, approximately 4,000 to 5,000 people, in the center of the gold mining region of northeastern Chukotka, and then head to the southwest with the main line going down as far as Yakutsk in the Sakha Republic, where there needs to be a very large bridge built. There actually is work going on now to extend the railway to the north from where its northern terminus is near Burkakit and Aldan to Yakutsk, but the bridge is a major obstacle that has to be dealt with on the Lena River, because if the river is very wide, it's at the minimum point for several hundred miles in each direction. It's 3 miles wide, so it's a very big river. Right now, there is no bridge, and in the wintertime, they have trucks going on the river and driving, and then in the summertime, boats. But there's a period in the spring and the fall where it's difficult transportation. I was there in 1996, and I was in Chukotka in 1997, and I was in Nome, Alaska in 2001 for the Alaska-Chukotka Summit Conference. Now, the railway would be hauling oil, coal, potash, forest products, containers, and interestingly enough, going between China and the United States, we would have a very competitive time of 8 to 10 days in total, whereas compared to the existing ship rail system, it's 20 days or more. With all water shipping, it would be closer to 30 days, but with the Panama Canal opening in 2014 with a considerably widened capacity, that's obviously an issue, but there is a definite need. And of course, the real issue here of building the Bering Strait Tunnel is building the railroad up to Alaska is really what makes it possible to build the North American Water and Power Alliance, because of all the equipment and materials that needs to be hauled, and making it possible to get that project built. With the water, there's going to need to be some relocations and some bridges and some viaducts to be built because the additional water is going to complicate the routing, but it's certainly nothing that's impossible, and it would certainly benefit a great deal because we'd be putting thousands and thousands of people to work. Now, the one political issue I see in the area is the First Nations in Canada, because a number of them, I'm told, are at least indirectly influenced through the Prince Philip Organization or the World Wildlife Fund, and they have a tendency to be anti-development, at least some of them, and are at least making things so complicated that nothing can happen, a la the American pipeline from the mouth of the Mackenzie River down to Alberta. The Imperial Oil Company has spent several hundred million dollars, and they don't have one foot of pipeline yet, and that's the sort of problem that one runs into. That has to be dealt with at some point. But basically what we're really talking about is we are developing a new transportation link and a new political interlinkage between the United States and Russia, which then makes it possible to implement the four-power agreement of Russia, China, India, and the United States together into a single transportation link connecting North America with Asia and Europe and, of course, with South America as well. And as I mentioned at the end of my speech in Berlin 2 weeks ago today, that really what we're really looking at is building a world railway system from Cape Good Hope at the bottom of Africa, at Cape Town, South Africa, all the way to Cape Horn, near Ushuaia, Argentina, at the far southern end of South America, and everything in between. And with this critical land linkage, we then have the possibility of eliminating any possibility of the British oligarchy, who has been fighting so much to keep these types of projects from happening, from ever having the influence in the future that they've had in the past, because people can be linked together with land corridors, which they have been trying valiantly since time immemorial to prevent from happening. And with that, I guess that summarizes pretty well what the Bering Strait Tunnel Project's about, Marcia.
Yes, I think so. You've given the geostrategic overview, and I bet Jean-Philippe in Montreal, you may want to respond to, I know you've looked at the North American Water and Power Alliance proposal for years. Now we're talking about, it's not just dusting it off, we're talking about as a gateway to a whole new potential for biological, for geophysical engineering. But what do you want to say for the view in Canada and for your personal take on this?
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd like to stress is just to pick up on where Hal left. This is a major political fight, and as Mr. Cooper mentioned on the 25th, when he talked about World War I being created as a way to prevent these kinds of projects at the time, we had the Bering Strait and other projects in Europe. The British Empire intervened and tried to stop those by creating ruckus, destabilizing countries. We see the same thing today with those environmentalist movements, with Prince Philip and other groups. You know, David Suzuki, who's well-known here, well-known Malthusian and ecologist. And I would like to say first that these environmentalist groups, when you organize the population on projects like NWAPA and the scientific idea, because obviously we're not just talking about putting dams or rails or, concrete all over the place. But we're talking about a science driver project that will actually help mankind get out of its misery and put the foundation for the next steps of scientific and cultural development. So when you talk to people in the street, you actually see that the British Empire, they're really bad at making scientific arguments. They really suck at it, and the way they promote environmentalism is really by scaring the pants out of people. You're human beings, don't touch anything. If you touch something, you'll destroy it. So when we organize people around NWAPA, and for example, the simple idea of man improving the biosphere with these projects, the idea as Vernadsky was talking about, Vladimir Vernadsky, the idea of the biogenic migration of Adam, that mankind helps improve the biosphere by getting all these atoms, whether it's iron, coal, or water, being spread on the earth, and also to manage all that migration, actually makes the earth more efficient. a lot of people recognize that idea as being true and quickly see that all these talks about solar panels in the desert, where you can actually increase the weather, kill all the bugs, and prevent any kind of biosphere to spread, right? No vegetation can grow in those deserts with those solar panels. People recognize that as being very silly. So the organizing here, and I'm sure this will reassure a lot of Americans, you know, we're not all stuck up about water and this is our water and don't touch my deserts.
I have to tell you, Jean-Philippe, an Army Corps engineer who's been active for 40 years in Canada and the U.S. said, the Canadians are going to tell you, if you take their water, it'll be like ordering them to kill their firstborn son. That's a quote.
No, that's the fear. Like,
yes.
all that propaganda really has stuck to some people's minds. But I would say that these projects really create a very good optimism in the population, and people see these projects as feasible. And the whole idea of improving the biosphere is really something that that makes people really rejoice as being a human being. So the idea is that this is a major political fight. It's not just like a nice option. It says this is the option that LaRouche has put on the table, which should have been done a long time ago, but wasn't done. And we can actually bring this project into being, change the whole biosphere, start really changing the weather in certain very harsh climates like Arizona, Texas, et cetera, or even the Canadian prairies that are getting desertified over the last few years, probably the last decade. And also to realize, you know, this is important that, you know, Canada is not this island where everything is, you know, beautiful. You can just walk in the street of Montreal and everybody, you know, shake each other's hands. There's an economic crisis here too. The manufacturing employment in Canada is at the lowest since 35 years. So we are also in a position where we're losing our engineers. The auto sector was tremendously hit over the last few years. So we're losing that potential. And the only way to stop this collapse is going to be, yes, through we're going to need a financial reorganization. We're going to need a major engineering feat like NWAPA, where you can actually it can actually force a cultural change in Canada. I don't know if I would suggest that people watch, if they haven't done that already, one of our latest video called NWAPA's Continental Implications, which pretty much shows the whole rail development that has to occur before, during, and after the NWAPA system being built. And you see all those rails throughout this massive land named Canada, which has only 30 million people, all stuck up at the border where it's a bit hotter. But you quickly see that with this project, with all the rails, all the three phases of the rail, the western spread of the rails, the rails also apart from the north, like from BC to Alaska, and then with the Bering Strait. And then after that, you have the mining, I guess you can call it the mining rails, but the rails will be northern Yukon, Northwest Territories, Nunavut, to go get the minerals for the future. And then what you see is that you have a nation which is forced to make a cultural shift, right? To go really say, okay, how can we be 100, 200 million over the next few decades to make that project happen? And which is also a very polemical aspect to the project, but which is also necessary, you know, as we've talked about. We're going to need a lot of minds We can just, you know, we can't just import everybody from Europe or something like that. You got to be able to develop the population much more in terms of ideas, in terms of science, and have this population to grow to be able to inhabit the northern part of Canada, and also being part of these other projects like space program, which is also part of the NWAPA, a study of cosmic radiations, so on and so forth. So yeah, the response is very good. We've been meeting a lot of teachers from different universities. Also, we've been calling certain companies up north. There's some pessimism because sometimes people are working on certain projects that never seems to be accomplished. So when you talk about them about new projects, they're a bit skeptical. But in general, the project has forced a lot of engineers or scientists to break free from their littleness. For example, we were at a water conference in Montreal. The International Water Association held a 4-day conference. But everybody there was rethinking in terms of environmentalist, small thinking. For them, a water policy is to catch rainwater and give it to the poor. There's no idea of irrigation. Irrigation is bad because you change the rivers, and we know it doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera. There were very few people that were there, like this company, SNC-Lavalin, who obviously has a big mind. They've been doing big projects throughout the world. But you also have these scientists. And it was very fun to talk with them because you have all these scientists or these politicians involved in small projects, like trying to clean up different small lakes in the north of Ontario. So, they talk about their subject and they have certain knowledge about science of how you clean up a lake, for example. But when you ask them, how are you going to clean up the Great Lakes, which is obviously this massive... it's probably as big as certain European countries, but just in terms of water. So, and then you see their eyes light up, and they take this deep breath, and then they start thinking. So, wow, okay, let me think, right? So you sort of reactivate their knowledge, their creativity, and they're actually able very quickly to get some kind of a general assessment of what it would take. So if you just think about the help that the government can do from that standpoint, just like finance and protect these sorts of big projects, whether it's cleaning up the lakes or making the WAPA, I don't think we'll have much problem in terms of stimulating the scientific community. I think we'll be generally very happy about the project, and they won't, all this green stuff will gladly be put on the back burner, and we'll come back to it later after we've done the WAPA.
Thanks, and I know you and I and Hal probably know some of the same diehards. They're wonderful people in Whitehorse and places in the Yukon who've been trying to fight for rail for 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I have thought in recent weeks what might be their reaction. I'd like to see their face when they see NWAPA's Continental Impact LPAC feature video that you just mentioned, Jean-Philippe, mm-hmm. and see all this portrayed there. Let me ask, on the engineering you raised, because, of course, Montreal is one of the world's engineering training centers, I believe, how these kinds of viaducts, challenges, the Lena River Bridge, do you want to say, are there any other, permafrost question, Lake Baikal, right. I think has such a narrow border. Do you want to mention about some of these?
Well, I will, but I want to get to something else first.
Okay.
Jean-Philippe, you have mentioned the company SNC-Lavalin, is that correct?
Yeah, I did.
Yes, they were at this conference, right?
Now, did you talk with them?
Oh, yeah. I talked to two representatives of the company over there.
Now, do you have their names, telephone numbers, and all that?
Oh, I'm sure
yeah,
we have.
Yeah,
it
I do.
Yeah.
Listen, the reason I'm asking this is, do you think that they would become the champions of the Nuwapa Project in Canada?
If they become the champions, I don't know if they'll become the champions. The
no, we're talking about from the engineering standpoint.
Well, I think they have, from what I got from the, I spoke to one of the person that was, actually this is an engineer that was involved in the biggest pipeline project in Africa, in the north of Africa.
Yes.
And to him, this project is more than feasible.
Yes.
He only had, so I'd say that they can do a lot for that project, yeah.
Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is, I've been in fairly regular communications with Michael Kirsch, who's with the Basement Group, and he's sort of the de facto spokesman, and he's been the head of our various conference calls. He's been having discussions with the American engineering company CH2M Hill. Now, CH2M Hill is very interested in what Michael has been proposing, and it sounds like you have somewhat the same relationship beginning to be built with SNC-Lavalin, and I've worked enough in Canada to know the political influence of that company. It's all important. And I suggested to Michael in the United States that we set up a partnership on the political side with the LaRouche organization being the leader, and on the engineering side, CH2M Hill. And in Canada, I would just suggest we replace CH2M Hill and add SNC-Lavalin in their place. And has this gotten high enough up in the company that they can get to somebody who is a influential decision maker that can make this happen?
Well, can I intervene here? Because I think this is the kind of strategic discussion that our listeners should know is happening, and we can carry it on off the air, because it's just the same kind of thing with a couple of the other, it's like Siemens and Rail, you know what I mean, that just is building, as you well know, Hal.
Mm-hmm.
Involved in some of the major links of the world, and there are some of the big construction companies that are not innumerable ones, as you've just saying, you've got about a big 5 to 10 in the world and so forth. So besides on another show, I think we'll take it up off the air, but I'm glad it came up with this degree of specificity, because that is exactly where we stand when otherwise you think everything is completely hopeless as it's presented in your life, your television set, and your laptop. You know what I mean.
Well, and you know, as I told Michael yesterday, I said, you know, you and I in the LaRouche movement can promote this all we want, but if we don't have the people involved who can actually make it happen and do it, it's not going to happen.
Well, that's where our listeners and everyone else who's come alive around the world and doesn't have to be pessimistic anymore, as Jean-Philippe
right.
was saying, even those who thought they were green, right?
Well, and in the case of, and having worked enough in Canada to know what the political landscape is, the blessing of SNC-Lavalin is all important. And they, in combination with the work you and your organization are doing up there, I think you can parallel very closely what I've suggested to Michael Kirsch that we do in the United States. And in his case, I understand that this week that he's actually been contacted by somebody from CH2M Hill's headquarters in Denver, and you probably need to have the same type mm-hmm. relationships in Montreal with SNC-Lavalin. And if that, we can begin to make this project actually come to reality.
Right. So that shows the excitement. What I'd like to, one thing about it, let me just take up the, I wanted to get to another conference that might have taken place in Montreal. I think the same thing happened on the, it was a World Energy Conference that mm-hmm. was, that the enemy, the literal foot soldiers for the British Empire were there trying to say, go for windmills, go for this, go for that, from some of the major oil companies. But the attendees were different. But Hal, one thing is, I think you should reiterate for our listeners how long the Bering Strait, like it was mentioned, pre-World War One proposal has been out there. How?
Right. Well, the first time this was ever proposed, the idea of the Bering Strait Tunnel was ever proposed, was in 1845 by the territorial governor of Colorado, William Gilpin. And there were a number of other proposals made, but a very serious one took place in 1906 with a company that was actually headquartered in New Jersey, of American, French, and Russian people who actually raised $6 million and did a feasibility study, and they were well on the way to raising $50 million to begin the detailed engineering and the construction when World War I just suddenly showed up on the agenda.
Mm.
And my own personal opinion is, agreeing with William Engdahl on this, that that's the reason World War I happened.
Yeah, that the line is drawn. Are you going to have development? Are you going to have deliberate playing off of chaos?
That's exactly right.
Now, and then taking it up through World War II from an engineering design point of view, could you mention about the Army Corps of Engineers assignment?
Certainly. Well, as the early work to develop the Alaska-Canada Railroad came about, with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in early 1942 doing a feasibility study of building the railroad up to Alaska, from actually a Fairbanks from Prince George, British Columbia. And that work was done over a seven-month period with the Seattle office of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. You should also be aware that on the Russian side, beginning in 1938 through 1940, under an agency of the NKVD, Ministry of State Security, better known as the Secret Police,
mm-hmm.
they actually did detailed engineering studies and laid out routes going from Western Russia at Forkuta all the way to Ulan at the Bering Strait, and also from the southwest at Skovorodino all the way to the Bering Strait. So a lot of that work was actually done some time. And at the early part of World War II, when the United States and Russia were discussing how the United States could supply the Russian war effort, it was Harry Hopkins who went to Washington or to Moscow and met with Molotov and Stalin about the possibility of supplying Russia from the United States. And one of the items on the agenda was the possibility of building a tunnel under the Bering Strait, but it was felt at the time it was going to cost too much, it was going to take too long, it would take away from other things. So what they ended up doing was building a series of airfields from Great Falls, Montana to Nome, Alaska. And the reason that the Alaska Highway, or it was called the Alcan Highway at that time, was built, was a military highway through Canada, was actually to provide the fuel and supplies for these airfields so that these planes supplying Russia from the United States could actually fly over to Russia. And Russian pilots and navigators came over from the Russian side and they took the planes and supplies. Sometimes the Americans flew into Russia as far as Providenia and Adyr. But basically there was quite a shuttle service going on during the war. And in fact, I found out about this when I was up in the Yukon Territory in Whitehorse, and there was a book written about it. And so that's how I learned about this. But, you know, there are some previous efforts that certainly one needs to be aware of. And this was not a new idea to build the tunnel into the Bering Strait.
Right, and I think that you mentioned the Alcan Highway. It was built in a year during winter and everything else, right?
Nine months,
and it shows the. There are documentaries on this, which I advise people to see. But one thing it shows, the kind of crash effort, if we could start next week, if not tomorrow, for going into places with site preparation, you know, for the preliminary, I think they were almost doing the surveying within a few miles ahead of where the troops were building the actual.
That's exactly right. That is exactly correct.
Mm-hmm. And so again, it's what Jean-Philippe was referring. People get the sense that this is what we ought to be thinking about. We can do it. The pessimism can't help but lift. And in that sense, I wanted to ask you though, before the hour slips away, you can bring anything you want up, Jean-Philippe. But Hal, is permafrost an issue only in the farthest northern lines, as Jean-Philippe mentioned, in the mining area of the northernmost?
There actually are different zones of permafrost. There's the permanent, which actually you can design around fairly easily. Basically, what you have to do is you have to build your embankments of soil at least 4 feet high above where the normal ground level is. See, railroads can dissipate heat fairly quickly. They have ballast, and the heat can dissipate. It's when you build a road, and with asphalt, it absorbs the heat, and then the heat doesn't go away, and then what ends up happening is it melts the permafrost. So in these northern areas, they always build the rail at least 4 feet high. Now, you can use things like cryogenic freezing to make sure the ground stays stable. There's actually more of a problem in the areas where the permafrost is more of a transitional nature. It's there part of the time and not others. It's a little bit more tricky there, but the same techniques can basically apply. And I can tell you from my own experience that having been over in Russia and talking with the people there, they are just masters at understanding what it takes to build in these very cold climates. And I'm sure there are people in northern Canada, just that in Russia they have far more experience building and operating railroads in these very cold regions, like the line from Moscow to Murmansk has been in operation for almost 100 years, and it's a double-track electric line, and it's been hauling lots and lots of people and lots of goods for a very long time. And I think that would be a perfect example of what we need to do as far as these railroads. Now, Alaska Railroad certainly has experience, and the Northern Canadian as well, but not to the extent that they have in Russia, because they rely far more on the railroad operations in Russia than they do in North America.
And
that's my answer.
And everyone always asks you, Hal, again, as I say, Jean-Philippe, jump in at any time, but the tunnel building itself, relative to, can you locate this relative to some other tunnels people might
be familiar? Well, the English Channel Tunnel would be a perfect example.
Okay.
And actually, in some respects, the Bering Strait Tunnel, while it's longer, is easier to build than the English Channel Tunnel was.
Is it because of the substrate or the?
Well, that's a part of it, and that there weren't any. I understand not as. The soil is more stable at the Bering Strait than it was under the English Channel, especially near the French coast, I understand, from the people that were doing the building.
Oh, good. So, anyway, Jean-Philippe, you're saying that the conditioning is lifting. I mean, the anti-development, the nature is fixed, this kind of, you were hitting on the subjective mood of people, that a shift can be made, especially as people look are under these collapsing conditions anyway. Is that to go back?
Yeah,
to that?
It's. I would say it's similar to the reactions we have also when we organize around Obama in Canada.
Okay.
Because you have such support for Obama, not having a clue what he's doing, but you know, he's black, he's liberal, whatever. They like him. He's not George Bush, so
yeah,
everybody
right.
loves him. That was the organizing around that was hard. Maybe a year ago, people were more, you know, like we used the mustache to the Obamas with his Hitler mustache.
Yeah.
But today, organizing around, for example, we just used the idea of, you say we're going to replace Obama by a Nawapa.
Oh.
So people stop and they wonder, and then we explain to them what is the project, and. Like the Obama frenzy is also lifting away. Just like this, all this green stuff.
Yes.
I mean, it just, you know, it's like green stuff. It's green stuff. It's like having a cold. So you get rid of it, and then you start breathing better, you know. So, and the, like we had a very successful presentation a few days ago, last Wednesday here in Montreal, where we had 25 people who came, different age brackets, and people were very attentive to the whole project and what it means really for the development of mankind, because obviously Nawapa must be brought into the countries. Like the concept of Nawapa has to be put on the in Africa, in Eurasia, and everywhere it's feasible, everywhere we have these challenges for the development of the population, which also brings the question of LaRouche's Four Powers Agreement. Like Canadians will need a force like Russia as a partner, you know, because you want to use their knowledge for the development of the North, the mining resources, the rail, et cetera. And also to have these nations, China, India, Russia, the United States, to really lead the whole world out of this big mess. And yeah, and then, you know, green stuff just goes out by the orifices and then you're free.
And let me ask you, is there, in this sense of the frontier of the far north, the Great Arctic, that I think, you know, with Canada and Russia among the seven nations of the North, is there anything special you want to say about that?
Well, I'd say that there are some discussions here. For example, the the premier here of Quebec has been discussing about a great north strategy for development of the north. Uh-huh. The problem is that it's very it's weather based on globalization, in a sense that, you know, they will talk about different ship routes to provide for the Chinese or to provide for the Indians. But we're not talking about, like for example, most of the Indian tribes in the north of Quebec, they use like mazut. They have very low, very cheap energy. These guys are living in ghettos, pretty much. And there's like nobody talking about having a rail over there, bringing like hydropower or something, you know, which we have a lot.
Sure.
Bringing a real development in those regions. So those projects brought up right now won't work because the mindset is just wrong. Canada cannot simply be, for example, a uranium exporter for China. You have to develop the nuclear technology here as well. To just think about shipping the resources out is obviously a problem. You're just saying, well, it'll be easy. The Chinese, they're buying everything, so let's just send them all our stuff.
Yeah, people should know you have very rich uranium in Saskatchewan.
Yeah, so in Saskatchewan, and also... there's this question, which is very interesting, that in the north, in the Arctic, you have some uranium resources that are much more pure than other uranium ore that you'll find on the rest of the country or other places.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings into question the idea of cosmic radiation, which hits more the poles than other places.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then to figure that out, you need a real mobilization. You'll need to have scientific cities, which we don't really have here. Scientists, I guess they can't buy mittens these days, so they don't want to go up there. You know, in crisis too. But no, we need this approach. This approach is going to develop the country for the next 100, 200 years, and we need to make scientific breakthroughs for that.
Right, and Hal, you've often spoken... You opened by talking about a whole world rail link. Do you want to say more about any special aspect of this, like the Darien Gap, which is in our hemisphere? We're talking about developing Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, but the Darien Gap is
sure.
Outstanding, isn't it, for what we need for this hemisphere?
I'll be discussing both Latin America and Africa because I've been doing work in both.
Great. Go ahead.
As far as North America is concerned, there's a great deal of development going on in Brazil, in Argentina, in other places in Latin America now. There is definitely a need to connect North America and South America. Sadly, the British oligarchy has gotten into Panama and other countries as well, and basically created a condition where we have a national park at the Darien Gap, which is basically prevented the Pan-American Highway from being completed through the Darien Gap. That needs to change. I put together a paper, which actually was presented at the International Railway Symposium in Istanbul, Turkey, in October of 2008, to actually build around it over the hills in the eastern part of Panama into the far northwest of Colombia, and then going south in... Actually, then we would have a network by which rail lines would connect both North America and South America together. There are some incremental spot areas being developed. Of course, Brazil has just issued an international tender for a high-speed rail system between São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, which is in association with their upcoming Olympics. There was a proposal to... build a similar rail line between Rosalía and Buenos Aires in Argentina, but I understand it broke down over financial issues. But the Chinese have come in, and they basically have offered to put up $10 billion to help Argentina develop both its urban and its rural rail systems, and that work is beginning to be underway. And, of course, once the Chinese commit to something, they don't let little things like minor financial problems get in the way of them getting things done, which, sadly, in the Western world, we've allowed to intervene. Now, in Africa, I'm working with Thomas Fuller, who is heads the LaRouche organization in Tacoma, Washington, Pierce County, Washington, and we're actually doing studies right now on, I put together a major economic development program for rail and electric transmission and water development in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Central Africa. And actually, there is enough electric generating capacity from hydroelectric on the Congo River Basin to serve all of Africa. All of Africa's electricity needs could be supplied at present levels from the Congo. Obviously, we want to improve their standards of living because their electricity use per capita and energy use and so forth are far, far below what they are in the Western world. And we want to improve that. And that is the kind of thing that we really need to be doing. And I actually will be doing expansions under that. I've laid the groundwork for a major rail network throughout the entire African continent and also electric transmission. Now, separately from that, the oligarchy group through the wonderful Club of Rome has proposed a solar energy development project in northern Africa to take build solar energy collectors and then shipping all the power to Europe and basically not benefiting the African continent. That was a competing proposal. When I was over in Germany, I was given the plan for the Desert Tech project, it's called, for the Club of Rome, and I was basically told we need to come up with something better than that, so I'm in the process of doing that right now. So that basically connects the last two links, Africa and South America, and that's what the intention is to do.
Right. Well, back to some of the engineering involved in all of this tremendous perspective, and in fact, scientific horizons, as you mentioned about the North Pole, the ionization and so forth. Jean-Philippe, is it, I don't know if you or just associates were involved in another, there was a World Energy Conference, I made reference to that, but it was in mid-September and Montreal hosts many world conferences. This was a big one.
Yeah.
And did you find the same thing, that the actual attendees, as opposed to the controllers of the mindset of the conference, were ready for what Hal was just describing?
Well, just maybe, yeah, there's been a lot of world conferences on different subjects. There's actually one coming up on North American railroads.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, in, I think it's mid-October. It will occur whether in Montreal or Ottawa. We're trying to see how we can intervene there, whether as media or different things. But the response we got at the energy conference was very different, for example, from the water conference. Because, you know, when you're in a water conference, you don't talk about more water, really. You don't talk about creating water. If you go to an energy conference, then you could talk about 100 gigawatts of hydropower, you know, from the Nawapa project. People are very interested. But I think the key thing we saw at this conference was actually the response and the people recognizing LaRouche, not just our movement, but actually having, whether read LaRouche material in the past or having followed him, having met him not too long ago. We had some very good responses from Russia, South Korea, and also from France. And this desert stuff, again, I'll give you just an example.
Okay.
I was talking to an engineer from, I think it was Algeria or Morocco, I forgot. There was the Maghreb, so the north of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself was involved in gas and oil pipelines. And he told me that he was involved with Desert Tech, so the project that Hal just mentioned, those solar panels all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But he was completely against it, although he was involved in it, because he actually experienced the fact that the companies promoting the project were actually trying to go beyond or pass above these Maghrebian governments.
Uh-huh.
So basically not dealing with them. And this Algerian or this Maghrebian had really like a, you know, like a national impulse to say, these guys are crazy. What are these guys' intention, really? But obviously, after a small discussion on the scientific fallacy of solar panels, the guy did not disagree. He actually saw my point. He understood my point. So the problem is really that's the whole idea of the four-power agreement, the idea of bringing back the nation states, because that's what's at stake.
Well, that seems to be the best point we can end on. The time has slipped by, I can't believe it. this is a question of existence of our nation state and the system of nation states itself. And I thank you very much. This is the closeout of October 9th, 2010, LaRouche Show. Jean-Philippe Leblou in Montreal. Hal Cooper, great to have you in Seattle. And we're going to continue this, and everyone, November 6th, put that on your calendar. Mr. LaRouche will give an international webcast again, and by then, I hope we're in the new domain of going ahead with the credit system and the projects, and goodbye, Obama. Thank you very much. This is Marcia Mary Baker.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.